Friday opening session of Sunstone. In your programs, you'll note that this is Swear Not at All, Goals in the Temple Endowment. I think all of us have had some introduction to swearing in the past. I was introduced to it by milking cows for about 6 years straight, and anybody who's had anything to do with cows, I'm sure, knows that you can't escape dealing with them without having some acquaintance with swearing. After 15 years in the Army, I've become quite an expert. I won't say that I'm real proficient at it, but one can't help but gain something by association. Our two presenters, well, one presenter and one respondent this morning. First is Dennis Clark. He works at the Orem Library as a cataloger. He says that he's a poet by profession, a librarian by occupation, and by inclination a nascent theologian. He says that this makes him not just schizophrenic, but deeply split. I'm glad to see that he looks reasonably intact this morning anyway. He's presented for years at the Sunstone Symposium, but never once been asked to publish any of his papers. Falls into the category with several of us, I guess. But even worse, he says he was the poetry editor at Sunstone, and during the whole time, none of his poetry was even published. He has offered to talk to us today on the topic. Whoa, wait a minute, what's this here? Oh, this is a title change for the paper. Oh, now, I'm sorry, I hope this won't change any of your minds. He says the paper today is now entitled, Of Obscure Origin, Etymologies You Weren't Prepared to Hear. Responding to his paper is Clifton Jolly. Clifton has a PhD in English, previous to which he had taught for more than a decade with the LDS Department of Seminaries and Institutes and Brigham Young University Departments of English and Religion. I guess getting the PhD disqualified him from those pursuits, and so he went on to something else. He was a daily columnist for the Deseret News and host of KUED Civic Dialogue. Currently, he's president of Avenues Communications, whose national clients include U.S. Sprint. He also mentioned that, as far as what I should say about him, after his remarks, it won't really matter what I had said to introduce him. So with that, we'll turn the time over to Dennis Clark.
Clifton and I are cross-dressing this morning. He's dressed as the presenter, and I'm dressed as the respondent.
I have honest employment.
And I'm a government sponge. I soak up your tax money. There was a change of title involved here. And the title is now Swear Not at All, Oaths and the Temple Endowment, which is a little more honest, but certainly no more revealing. In our present gentility, in our search for bourgeois respectability, we Mormons have adopted habits of thought which obscure the meaning of the Lord's injunction in the Sermon on the Mount, Swear Not at All. With many conservative Christians, we classify as swearing a welter of different modes of expression, emphasis, and imprecation. We allow ourselves to be put off by people whose speech seems crude to us, or vulgar, obscene, profane, or blasphemous. We're made uncomfortable by speech which we would use only to offend, when others use it only as a form of emphasis or mere punctuation. All such departures from genteel speech we officially abhor, from the pulpit, in the pages of our magazines, in our Sunday school classrooms, but in so doing we mask from ourselves a more abhorrent behavior, the swearing of oaths. Bear with me while I define five levels of speech which might be classed as departures from respectable discourse. None of them are swearing in the sense the Lord was speaking of, but my experience is that not one of you here would fail to recognize them as a form of swearing prescribed by our leaders. They are in descending order of respectability, or rather in what should be ascending order of offensiveness to us, and the two orders are not the same. Crudity, vulgarity, obscenity, profanity, and blasphemy. Most of these definitions will come from the Random House Dictionary of the English Language. Those that do not will mostly come from the American Heritage Dictionary, which you'll hear me refer to as AHD. That will speed this up considerably. Crudity is the state or quality of being crude, which in turn means in a raw or unprepared state, unrefined or natural, lacking in intellectual subtlety, lacking finish, polish, or completeness. It comes into English from the Latin crudus, uncooked, raw, bleeding, rough, akin to cruor, blood from a wound. The AHD traces it back to the hypothetical Indo-European root cru, which comes into English through Germanic as raw. Most slang can be classed as crude language, including such minced O's as G's and dang. These have neither the force of vulgarity and obscenity, nor the power of profanity and blasphemy. Note, however, that both of my examples, G's and dang, derive, as do many such expressions, from religious oaths. Such oaths seem to move from the blasphemous through the vulgar to the crude as they lose force. A good example of this is bloody, originally an oath sworn by the blood of Christ, then an offensive vulgarity as depicted in Shaw's Pygmalion, and now not much more than crude slang, where its use is noted at all. An example of a crude phrase which does not derive from a religious oath is the common missionary slang term flip, which is used as a verb, a noun, an adjective, an adverb, a participle, and replaces a far cruder obscenity in most cases. Whatever the source, though, the chief effect of such flip speech is to make our language colorful without making it any more effective in conveying the sense of what is said. Next, we come to vulgarity. The word derives from vulgar, characterized by ignorance of or lack of good breeding or taste. This word also comes into English from the Latin, from vulgaris, equivalent to vulgus, the general public, plus aris, which is undefined. Vulgus is marked in the AHD as of obscure origin, but we sometimes act as if anything arising from the general public were of obscene origin. Do we forget that our Lord was a carpenter of obscure origin, a Nazarene, a hick? Can there any good thing come out of Nazareth, Nathanael asked, or closer to home, that our prophet was the son of a destitute itinerant farm family considered of low repute by at least some of their neighbors? For that matter, did Joseph ever forget? The phrase, get the shaft, is an example of a vulgar expression current in my youth, and one which I was chastised more than once for using. It and other middle-class vulgarities appear to be in the process of being supplanted by what some delicately refer to as the F-word, or in a phrase revealing of class differences and biases underlying much of the matters of usage, the Eddie Murphy word. This and other upwardly mobile obscenities are losing their edge through constant exposure, but of far greater import to us is that they are part of the lingua franca of an entire class of people to whom we as Christians, as Mormons most especially, are sent, to the poor, the oppressed, the humiliated, the downtrodden, the underclass. Obscenity, the next term, derives from the Latin obscenus or obscenus. The Latin is undefined in Random House, but defined in AHD as ill-boding, inauspicious, or repulsive. The first two definitions indicate a connection with divination, a priestly function. This word also is marked in AHD as of obscure origin, which means that it can't be traced to even a hypothetical Indo-European root or to another language family. Webster's Third takes a stab at it, however, saying this is probably from a prehistoric Latin compound whose first constituent is akin to the Latin ob, to, before or against, and whose second constituent is akin to the Latin canum, filth. Compare the Swedish dialectal ven, swamp, and the Latvian svins, dirtied. Now they do go a bit far afield on some of these. Certainly, whatever its origin, this is not a civilized word. But if all that genealogy comes even close to accuracy, this word originates inside the temple, or at least before the altar. Remember, its primary meaning was inauspicious or ill-boding. Taken together, these antecedents might indicate a besmirched ceremony, an augur dropping into the dust the entrails he was trying to read. Nowadays, obscene refers to a small group of words of ancient, if not honorable, lineage, most dealing with body parts and discharges, sexual and excremental. Words move into and out of this class in strange ways. Snot is marked in AHD as vulgar at present, rather than obscene. So is piss, although it was at least neutral enough in 1611 to be used in the authorized version to translate literally a Hebrew phrase describing one that pisseth against a wall, which in the LDS edition of the AV is glossed as a derisive term for any male. Just another clear instance of patriarchy. Run rampant. Honest, if not genteel, Hebrew. Your response to both of these words will tell you where they fit in your own idiolect. And once again, such words as these tend to occur in the dialect of the oppressed: soldiers and sailors, slaves and servants, beggars and bums. Profanity, our next category, derives from the adjective profane, from the Latin profanus, literally before or outside of the temple, with a parallel development of the verb meaning desecrated, profaned. AHD adds hence not sacred, secular, impious. AHD traces it to the Indo-European root of phanus, which is face, the root of the words feral, fair, festival, and possibly the Greek theos, god, and also the root of fanatic, from that phanum. If we are to be fanatic in decrying any mode of speech, it would more properly be profanity than obscenity. The most impious speech many of us can imagine is what we inaccurately refer to as taking the name of the Lord in vain. That phrase, however, refers to a different kind of conversation. In such passages as, quote, just Lot, vexed with the filthy conversation of the wicked, the word conversation could more accurately be translated by behavior or way of life. It is Christ's way of life that we are to take upon us in taking the name of Christ and attempting to live as Christians. I'm correcting typos as I go along here, in case you're wondering. I'm not rewriting the paper. I'm not writing it as I go along, but it sounds like that. Clifton has said they won't want to publish this one either, but at least they're going to record it. That is my true topic today, taking upon us the name of Christ, attempting to live as Christians. And unless I handle it very carefully, this talk may prove to be profane, more so than any crude vulgarity obscenely hurled at you. And finally, at the Antipodes, we encounter blasphemy. Blasphemy comes into English through Latin from the Greek blasphemine, to speak profanely. Derivative of blasphemos, defaming or speaking evil. Equivalent to blapsis, harm or evil, which comes from blab, harm, plus sis. Compare blaptine to harm. Plus phemos, speaking, derivative of phemi, speech. Now that may sound like a lot of blab to you, but what it tells you is that this term comes from the realm of the curse, from speech designed to harm another person. Definitely a religious connection, but one not necessarily limited to the gods, since curses can be made in the name of demons and all other forms of religious life. A curse in the name of religion, especially Christianity, would combine elements of the profane with the desire to harm another. Again, some of these curses persist in our common interjections, damn and hell, or the less common but far more offensive, damn you to hell, or more formally, may God in heaven damn you to hell. My children will often use the minced oath, heck, when discussing the theological concept of hell, when they don't say H-E double toothpick, as it survives in Mormon doctrine, perhaps in fear of invoking the damned. And this despite the fact that any such oath from a Mormon would have no theological potency, since we do not believe that God damns anyone to any condition of life hereafter, and especially not at the behest of another person. So we end up with blood, filth, the mobile vulgus, which is the origin of the term mob, evil speaking, and the temple. It's from these arise our common words to describe garden variety swearing. The body, with its blood, sweat, and tears, is not well represented in this menage, nor are the common people, but they persist, while gentility is the first thing in hard times to go. The injunction of Jesus, however, was against none of these. He did not have in mind crude, vulgar, obscene, profane, or blasphemous speech when he urged us to swear, not at all. Not even curses were his target in this part of the Sermon on the Mount. They're covered earlier in his discussion of murder and anger. In this part of the sermon, Jesus is discussing, expanding, and perfecting the Mosaic Law, telling his disciples how they should live to fulfill that law. Rather than habits of speech, the Lord enjoins us in Matthew 5:33-37 against the making of oaths, especially oaths by which we intend to guarantee our performance. Again, ye have heard that it hath been said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths. But I say unto you, swear not at all. Neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Neither shalt thou swear by thy head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black. But let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay. For whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil. This admonition is repeated in the Epistle of James, noting that James 5 and 12 has the statement somewhat differently. W.F. Albright and C.S. Mann suggest that his version may be a reminiscence of Jewish legal opinion that yes and no are oaths if repeated twice. Bo Reiki, in his commentary on the Epistle of James, noted the brevity of the text in James as opposed to that in Matthew, and argues that the author is probably not dependent upon the Gospel of Matthew for this teaching, but preserves another tradition in the early church. What is the intention in this admonition? It is undoubtedly to emphasize the preceding instruction to be patient. The connection with the previous statements is clear from the introductory words above all. Among the recipients of the letter, swearing appears to have been a means of expressing impatience with their lot and bitterness at the oppressive social order. Note again this response to an oppressive social order, the taking of oaths. It occurs in the context of anxiety, an anxiety centered around the expectation of the imminent return of Christ. This expectation, so pervasive in LDS thought, was equally involved in the anxiety suffered by James's readers. I'm repeating myself for emphasis. In Reike's translation, the context of James's version is, "Therefore, be patient, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. You know the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth and is patient for it until it has received the early and late rains. You be patient also. Strengthen your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is near. Do not grumble at each other, brothers, so that you may not be judged. You see, the judge is standing at the door. Take the prophets as an example of long-suffering and patience, who spoke in the name of the Lord. Indeed, we regard as blessed those who endure." That's a quote. "You have heard of Job's perseverance and the Lord's final dealing with him, because the Lord is compassionate and merciful. Above all, my brothers, do not swear, either by heaven or the earth or any other oath. But let your yes be yes and your no be no, so that you may not come under judgment. If any one of you suffers, let him pray. If anyone is happy, let him sing hymns. If any one of you is sick, then let him call the elders of the congregation," and so forth. We who await the Lord with all the patience of farm boys assigned to muck out the stable, hoping for anyone else at all to fall in and swab it out, would do well to cultivate that same long-suffering. But I appear to digress. Again, the Lord's injunction is specifically against the taking of oaths intended to guarantee our performance. Levers that we try to employ against ourselves to jack ourselves up to a higher level of living. Such oaths are described in several places in the Old Testament. I'll look at three of those places. First, Numbers chapter 30, verses 2 and 3. Moses spoke to the heads of the Israelite tribes, saying, "This is what the Lord has commanded." And I'm using here the translation of the Jewish Publication Society of America because it's contemporary. It's in our own language and idiom. It's clearer. But it doesn't disagree with the Authorized Version at this point. It's just easier to hear it. Moses spoke to the heads of the Israelite tribes, saying, "This is what the Lord has commanded. If a man makes a vow to the Lord, or takes an oath imposing an obligation on himself, he shall not break his pledge. He must carry out all that has crossed his lips." Oaths in the name of the Lord were particularly solemn, as recorded in Leviticus 19 and 12. "You shall not swear falsely by my name, profaning the name of your God. I am the Lord." And the word translated Lord there is Yahweh. That is the covenant name of God with Israel, in the view at least of Jews. So when you make a vow in the name of Yahweh, you've made a particularly strong oath. In fact, the caution enjoined by Jesus is to some extent presented in the law by Moses, thus in Deuteronomy 23:21-23. "When you make a vow to the Lord your God, do not put off fulfilling it, for the Lord your God will require it of you, and you will have incurred guilt. Whereas you incur no guilt if you refrain from vowing. You must fulfill what has crossed your lips and perform what you have voluntarily vowed to the Lord your God, having made the promise." Now notice, "whereas you incur no guilt if you refrain from vowing." Okay. Once again, "you must fulfill what has crossed your lips and perform what you have voluntarily vowed to the Lord your God, having made the promise with your own mouth." Simply put, the difference is that Jesus urges his disciples not to make the oath. That may be a little clearer in a less familiar translation, this one by Albright and Mann. Again, you have heard that it was said by the ancients, do not make vows rashly, but be careful to pay any vows made to the Lord. But I tell you, do not swear at all. Not by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by earth, for it is his footstool, nor by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. That's David, incidentally. Do not swear even by your head, for you cannot make one hair black or white, and believe me, I've tried. Let your words be yes and no. Anything more than this is of evil origin. Albright and Mann point out that the emphasis in the law is not on the way in which a man binds himself, but on his obligation to perform his promise. They suggest that Jesus opposes himself to all distinction in his oaths, a distinction which a casuist might interpret as determining the relative solemnity of one promise against another. They might also suggest, and I will suggest, that he opposes oaths because they bind one to a select performance. With an oath, the emphasis becomes my performance rather than your need. Yes, I will live as Christ did is an open-ended vow, which is the vow we make at baptism. I will visit seven widows today and heal four of the sick is a goal, an oath. It narrows the field of view, constricts the possibilities of action, and limits the awareness of need to a need that fits my goals. The kinds of oaths I've examined so far were no different in intent from a kind of oath far more virulent, the simile oath. An example of this kind of swearing is Jezebel's oath against Elijah. After he had the 450 prophets of Baal slain for failing to call down fire on their altar, Jezebel said, or swore, "So let the gods do to me, and more also, if I make not thy life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time." That is misquoted in the published abstract of this paper, but it's close enough. A further example is found in the tale of David and Abigail when he says, "So and more also do God unto the enemies of David, if I leave of all that pertain to him by the morning light any that pisseth against the wall." Not pretty oaths. In the Old Testament, such oaths occur only in Samuel and Kings and once in Ruth. That means that they appear primarily, if not exclusively, in the work of the Deuteronomist. Those of you unfamiliar with the documentary hypothesis and the scholarship resulting from it, part of the recent work on biblical textual history is a hypothesis that one person is responsible for the production of Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, both books of Samuel, both books of Kings, possibly Ruth, and possibly Jeremiah and Lamentations. Thought to be either Baruch or Jeremiah, this author apparently produced the Deuteronomic history, or Deuteronomistic history, depending on who's book you're reading, right after the first leading away the first return of the king of Judah from Babylonian captivity, and then revised it right after the onset of the Babylonian captivity as an attempt to explain why Israel fell and why there was no longer a king descended from David on the throne in Jerusalem when God had promised David that his descendants would reign forever on that throne. That is also the throne of the great king which Christ is to inherit on his return, the way we read the New Testament and the Old Testament. So this was an attempt to explain why Israel had failed. The book is written as a record of failure. As I say, the oaths occur only in Samuel and Kings, and once in Ruth. They are a kind of oath apparently common not only to the Israelites, but to the entire ancient world. Edward E. Campbell discusses them in his commentary on the Book of Ruth. This solemn oath formulary appears only here, and in 11 passages in Samuel and Kings, and since I don't read Hebrew, I take his word for that. The first part of it, thus do God to me, or so and more also do God unto the enemies of David, the first part of it was presumably accompanied by a symbolic gesture, something like our index finger across the throat. Deep behind this lay, in all probability, a ritual act involving the slaughter of animals, to whom the one swearing the oath equated himself. The best indications that this is so are the portrayals of elaborate covenant ratifications containing solemn oaths in Genesis 15, 7 through 17, and Jeremiah 34, 18 through 20. Genesis is the oath that Abraham makes with God when he splits open the animals and lays them in two rows, and God passes between them and unites them. Jeremiah I haven't read recently, so I don't remember that, but it's somewhat the same kind of thing. And split animals represent what the oath taker invited God to do to him if he fails to keep the oath. Because they intend harm, such oaths are almost always blasphemous. At least I would consider them blasphemous under the definitions I worked out. These 11 oaths form the spine of the history of Judah and Israel, especially the history of the kings. But they find an earlier counterpart in the abomination of Jephthah's vow to sacrifice the first thing out of his door if God will only grant him victory. That story is told in Judges chapter 11. And if you'll recall the story, the first thing that comes out of Jephthah's door is his daughter dancing with a tambour to celebrate the victory. And Jephthah decides that he has to fulfill his vow because he's made a vow to God that he will sacrifice to God the first thing that comes out of his door when he gets home. She says, well, let me go off for 3 months into the mountains and mourn my virginity, and then I'll come home and we'll do it. So she does, and when she comes home, Judges very discreetly says that the vow is fulfilled. Doesn't describe it. But if you take that as the beginning of this sequence of oaths, and I think it is, I don't remember one earlier in Judges or in Joshua that fits this pattern. If you take that as the beginning, it makes a very nice series of incidents that at the end come back on themselves. I'll come back to that a little bit later. The whole topic is a very interesting topic, but it's also the topic for another paper, and I'm going to have to cut a fair amount of what I was going to talk about referring to that. But this is a relatively good summary. Almost all of the occurrences of simile oaths have the same function: to guarantee performance, and in some way to represent sacrifice. And in almost all cases in this narrative, the Deuteronomic history, the oath is frustrated. They almost always involve vengeance, the way Jezebel's does, the way David's does. The first one that is recorded in this form, the simile oath, is not. But it sets off a whole string of associations that are equally interesting. It occurs when Eli questions the youth Samuel about his visions in the night. Eli, if you'll recall, was the high priest. His sons were profane. They were not to inherit the priesthood. Samuel was pledged by his mother to God because she finally had a child. Another vow, another oath, but not one of these oaths. And it's during the time when Samuel is in the temple and comes to Eli three times in the night and says, "Here I am." And Eli says, "What?" And Samuel says, "Well, you called me." And Eli says, "No, I didn't." Then Eli called Samuel, this is the next morning, and said, "Samuel, my son." And he answered, "Here am I." And he said, "What is the thing that the Lord has said unto thee? I pray thee, hide it not from me. God do so to thee, and more also, if thou hide anything from me of all the things that he said unto thee." This almost casual extortion smacks more of unrighteous dominion than vengeance. But it does illustrate the tenuous nature of Samuel's hold on the priesthood. He is an apprentice, perhaps a slave to Eli. Far more typical is Saul's oath in 1 Samuel 14 and 44. This is the oath that Saul takes, that if he will be granted victory, none of his army will eat anything all day long. Jonathan dips his rod in some honey and tastes it. And Israel is then under condemnation. And Saul tries to find the source of the condemnation. Jonathan says, or the lot falls on Saul and Jonathan, then on Jonathan, if you recall that scene. "Then Saul said to Jonathan, tell me what thou hast done. And Jonathan told him and said, I did but taste a little honey with the end of the rod that was in mine hand, and lo, I must die. And Saul answered, God do so and more also. For thou surely shalt die. Thou shalt surely die, Jonathan. And the people said unto Saul, shall Jonathan die, who hath wrought this great salvation in Israel? Jonathan won the victory. God forbid, as the Lord liveth," the Lord being the translation of Yahweh, "as the Lord liveth, there shall not one hair of his head fall to the ground, for he hath wrought with God this day." So the people rescued Jonathan, that he died not. David did not carry out his oath against Nabal's household. Jezebel did not carry out her oath against Elijah. And the other instances, almost all of them, the oath is frustrated consistently. And almost all of them, as in the case of Elijah and Samuel, involve in some way an oath directed against a prophet. Not almost all of them, many of them. An oath directed against a prophet. Very interesting. The last one, I'm going to skip all of the intervening ones, which are interesting in their own way. And almost all of them are involved in the story of the rise of the house of David. The last one occurs after the destruction of the kingdom of David, after you have two kingdoms, Israel and Judah, after Solomon has taken the southern kingdom, Solomon's son has taken the southern kingdom and Rehoboam has taken the northern kingdom. And it involves the attack on Samaria by Ben-Hadad. Samaria has been laid siege. And Elisha, if you'll recall, who is Elijah's successor, the man on whom the mantle falls, Elisha has done two things that aggravate the siege. First, he has sent a messenger to Ben-Hadad, or he's gone to Ben-Hadad, following Elijah's instruction. Elijah had three goals set for him by God when he was in Sinai. One was to anoint Elisha to succeed him, or to find a successor. One was to anoint Jehu to be the king of Israel, to succeed Jezebel's husband. I can't remember the name right now. And the who? Ahab, thank you. And the third is to tell Ben-Hadad that he will be a scourge for Israel, which is the dominant kingdom, interestingly enough, right now. Elijah anoints Elisha to be his successor and then goes off into the heavens in a chariot of fire. Elisha sends one of his sons, one of this group of young men who follow him, to Jehu to anoint him. If you recall that story, he walks in where Jehu is sitting around with the other captains, takes him in a back room, anoints him, and then runs for his life. Elisha goes to Ben-Hadad in Syria, puts his hands on the man's shoulders, looks into his eyes, and starts to weep. He can't bring himself to tell Ben-Hadad that he is going to be the kingdom, the element of scourging. But one thing he does do is tell Jehoram the king that this town is going to be sealed up by drought and you're going to suffer. Well, it's during that drought and siege that the final form of the oath occurs. It's sworn by Jehoram, and it's directed against Elisha the prophet. This is the context. Jehoram is asked to settle a dispute between two women. Suffering from hunger brought on by the siege, they had agreed to eat their sons. But after they had boiled and eaten the first woman's son, the second woman hid her son, refusing to sacrifice him. And it came to pass, when the king heard the words of the woman, that he rent his clothes, and he passed by upon the wall, and the people looked, and behold, he had sackcloth within upon his flesh. Then he said, God do so and more also to me, if the head of Elisha the son of Shaphat shall stand on him this day. Not a very savory instance of oath making. But with it we've come full circle back to an instance when a vow thoughtlessly made results in the sacrifice of a child. With a history like that, it's no wonder that Christ warned his disciples away from the making of oaths. Bear in mind, all of these oaths are intimately connected to the history of the rise of the house of David. Ruth's form of the oath diverges from these others in several very interesting ways. Campbell translates it in these words, thus may Yahweh do to me, and thus may he add, if even death will separate me from you. Ruth intensifies the oath by explicitly taking it twice. Usually the vague and more also suffices. This greater willingness to submit to the Lord's will is intensified by the fact that she uses the covenant name Yahweh, the name that the Israelites took upon themselves when they accepted Moses' leadership. By this name, Ruth pledges that her God is now Yahweh, even unto death. She will be buried as the Israelites are buried, mingling her bones with those of Naomi and her family. This is the oath by which the great-grandmother of David, a Moabitess of the incestuous blood of Lot, became an Israelite. So Ruth is tied into this history of the rise of the house of David. And it is out of the house of David that Christ comes. Bear that in mind. Until April 1990, these oaths found a counterpart in the temple endowment, in an oath more nearly related to Ruth's than any of the others. The correlative element should be clear enough to anyone who has taken that oath, involving both the performance of a given act and a willingness to die in conjunction with failure. In fact, the connection Campbell discusses between animal sacrifice and the simile oath helps clarify the oath formerly taken in the endowment. It was always strangely passive, a refusing to resist evil more than a willingness to fight for truth, refusing to resist even to the point of allowing oneself to be killed rather than profane the endowment. What did we lose when that oath was removed from the endowment ceremony? Perhaps what Scott Card described in his definition of temple, and this comes from Saint Speak, a Mormon dictionary. Another dictionary here. Typically a humorous dictionary, but not in this definition. I think Card found himself wrestling with a difficult problem. Didn't want to profane the temple, but couldn't ignore it. This is the definition, temple, the place of the sharing of gifts. The saints offer to the Lord their time and service in helping those who cannot help themselves. In exchange, the Lord gives the saints a retreat from the world, a place where time slows down and familiar rituals teach the body what the mind may not yet be able to learn. I like that definition. I'd claim it as my own, but Scott's already published it, so... That leaves us with the question, did we lose the instruction of the body when we lost the oath? No, I say. We saw it freed. Such an oath is an abstraction incarnate, a vow enacted on the body's flesh and blood. In removing the oath, the church made the covenant of secrecy one of assent, one to which we can say yes or no. In an age when nearly everyone knows, let alone cares, what Nancy Reagan had for lunch in the White House, such reticence may seem more than a little quaint. With the changes made in the endowment in April of 1990, the covenant in the temple became more nearly what Jesus recommends. What to many people had seemed the bloody relic of a barbaric era was removed from the endowment ceremony. The obligation to honor the sacred nature of the endowment was not taken out. If anything, it was intensified because it became an internal obligation, not represented by the threat of persecution, not expressed as a passive acceptance of fate, and not expressed as the will of a harsh deity. And yet, we seem as a people to have been yoking ourselves to just such a fated acceptance recently. I'll indulge in one final definition. This is my own. A goal is the instrument of the bourgeois salesman for measuring his failure. And yet, goals have begun to take the place of honor in our repertoire of obedience. I have seen and heard enough examples of it lately, by that I mean the last 20 years, to wonder about why we do such things. That's getting lately for someone as old as I am. I am referring to a tendency we have to set goals for temple work and for everything else, but I'll focus on temple work. And I wonder, are we going to gentrify this behavior as we have gentrified our speech, straining out a gnat and swallowing whole the camel of hypocrisy? Are goals going to become what replaces honor? Sometimes the goals reflect the number of endowments we will perform in the next 12 months. Sometimes they reflect the number of times in a week or month we will attend the temple. With some church leaders, this is a feature of the temple recommend interview. With others, it is implied in the goal card handed to the interviewee. In both cases, in all other cases, the setting of goals seems to me to violate the spirit of the Lord's injunction. Our yes and no should be enough to validate our performance. The goals are exactly parallel to the oaths Christ enjoins us from making. That's the problem with any oath. It changes the locus of one's attention. Without an oath, one can live contingently, aware of the needs of others and their desires, and respond to them with a yes or a no. Sometimes you don't want to respond to the desires of other people, but a yes or a no is sufficient. One can be an instrument in the hands of Jesus Christ only if one has no other end, no other goal than that end most abhorrent to the rugged individualist, which is to be used. I'll repeat that because I like it. One can be an instrument in the hands of Jesus Christ only if one has no other goal, no other goal, and most abhorrent to the rugged individualist, which is to be used. But having made an oath, and a goal is an oath, a goal is an instrument wherewith we seek to ensure our performance fully as much as may God do thus to me and more. It's just that the God we invoke now is Cal, deity of calendar and the calculator. Sorry, Cliff, you'll have to overcome that one too. Luckily, I left mine in my wallet, which is in my briefcase. It's just that the God we invoke now is Cal. We focus our attention with an oath on our own acts. We must perform as we have vowed, and we then live for ourselves, for our own ends, rather than to be of service to others. That's what a goal does. Focuses our attention and our efforts on our own ends, on our own sworn needs. A goal blinds us to means and becomes an overriding end that justifies whatever means one chooses to meet the goal. Yes and no signify intent. An oath enshrines it, making the tent into a temple, but a temple to ourselves, which is the ultimate profanity. Thank you.
The response is not included on this tape.